Welcome back, Monday Front Page 94.7, The Pulse. We're going housing now. Chris Foster Ramsey's been a regular on the show in the second half of 2023, and on our last show for the year, he's agreed to join us again for a chat about what is a very serious and continually confusing issue, and that is housing. Chris, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Rob.
Good to have you. And the big news that caught your eye last week and caught my eye and thought we should get you on, 17 square metres. That's not an awful lot of area in which one could live, let alone two, but it's worth $500,000, it appears.
Yeah, well, to put that into context, it's about half the size of your average Geelong hotel room, or one-third the size of a standard AFL goal square. So I think not enough room to swing a cat really is the definition here.
Yeah, well, that is one that springs to mind, but it just goes to show the desperation that the circumstances are in. And for someone, well, it's a little bit odd. You'd think if someone's got that sort of money to spend on a property, that they'd be in a position to try and get something a little bit more suitable. But even the thought of being able to on-sell it, you'd hardly think that it was a place that would increase in value. Surely not.
Yeah, I think at that level it would be hard to see capital growth in it, and from sort of my reading of the tea leaves, albeit, you know, not across the entire transaction, because I can't be, I think that it was a rental yield play here. I think the rental yield was quite good from all reports, and I think its location was probably very close and very desirable to the central area of Bondi and the beach. So I think, you know, I don't think it was a brain fade in terms of a purchase. I think it was a very strategic purchase, but it's something that would be very hard to on-sell, particularly if you're looking for capital growth.
So it's basically a bed and maybe a shower in the corner. You had to imagine that you'd get cooking facilities, but in this day and age, people tend to eat out anyway, so maybe the food side of it's not an issue. But what is interesting, though, and you made comment about it in your media release, is that the bank's valuation of it, even though it's made that at auction, sometimes banks and auction prices, the view of that, have a different view of what something's truly worth, and it's hard to imagine that it could be genuinely valued at that.
Yeah, it would be very hard to be valued at that, and the reason that it would probably, if it was valued by a bank, come in a little bit short would be due to a couple of reasons. First being comparable sales. I don't know that there'd be a lot of comparable sales for that type of square meterage. And secondly, there are a couple of issues with that particular home where it doesn't meet a standard lending criteria, which the bank's valuer is obliged to point out to the lending officer. So it would be very hard for that to be taken as, or to be lent against as a bank, you know, security.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. Have you had examples in other situations, maybe a traditional size property, where maybe the auction price or the sale price hasn't really matched what the market, and the market has to have a consistency about it for banks to use as a true valuation. Have there been other examples of whether that's out of kilter?
Yes, they have, and we would probably have one or two a month where valuations are problematic. We see a lot of issues around broadacre land development, so new areas that are popping up with house and land packages. They can be problematic in the change in value in land at present from its peak prior, you know, in 2022 when things started to move around building prices and stock availability, etc. So they're probably the most problematic. Auctions can also be problematic if it goes way above what anyone was expecting because of the issue of comparable sale. And thirdly, during COVID and around COVID, when Victoria was in lockdown, we saw a lot of issues with valuations where bank valuers made the point that the property wasn't able to be inspected by any purchaser. So therefore, virtual inspections had some play at that point on bank vals, but those areas have all come back now. So really all we're seeing is land, broadacre and vacant land in new areas becoming problematic at some point.
The other news overnight, or last couple of days, that the government making some changes to international owned properties, particularly ones that aren't occupied. It's only 1% of the market allegedly, but still 1% will be a lot of properties. It's 10,000 out of every million. Is this going to make a significant difference to the market at the moment, or do you think it's just government paying a bit of lip service to some pressure coming from the community?
Yeah, I think in theory it's good. I think in practice it may be difficult. I think for those that invest potentially from overseas who have an investment in Australia for whatever reason, it's more of a lack of a better word, business transaction to them, and if it costs them more to have it vacant, that will just be the cost of the investment going up. So I don't know that it's going to, in those cases where there's nobody in it, it's not owned by anyone in Australia, and it's just left vacant for investment purposes because that's how they want to work their money. Then I can't see it making a lot of difference. However, I would hope that that people who are able to rent their property for whatever reason and is vacant at the moment, that they're able to do so to ease some pressure on both affordability and availability.
I was going to ask you this question this morning anyway, but we'll do it now based on something you just said then about that house being an investment purely. At some stage, we changed from Australia that a house was an important part of everyday life, that people would work, they'd earn money, they'd buy a house, they'd raise their family. But we really do see them now in a lot of cases no differently to buying gold or shares in BHP. It is an investment for your future as opposed to your home. Where did that change, and what can we do to get it back, or will it never get back to the stage where a family home is just a right and an expectation that people will have a roof over their head?
It's such an interesting question, and it's got so many different angles to it, doesn't it? I mean, I would hope that it does come back to government policy changing and tax policy changing to be able to support Australians, which I've certainly been brought up on, where you work really hard and you buy a home and you live in a home and you bring up your family. I wouldn't have thought there will be a point in time, and it's probably during the early 2000s where government policy did change to encourage property investment and wealth building through property. I think that if you look at it purely from an investment side and the returns that it can offer against the other things that you mentioned there, it certainly rates highly within those assessment criteria. So, it is problematic, and I would hope that someone and some type of government, both state and federal, Australian-wide, has the confidence to be able to tackle or start to break down that big brick wall of investment versus own occupation.
Chris, you might have the numbers at your fingertips, but I'm led to believe that people defending the idea of having multiple homes as an investment for your future say that 65% of the investors are mum and dad investors that only have one or two homes. But on the counter side is that, from what I can gather, 20% of the investors own 80% of the homes. So that, to me, is way out of kilter. Is it simply saying, and I don't understand why it hasn't been talked about, that there's just a cap? You either cap it at 3 homes per investor or $5 million worth of property, whatever the case may be, to try and take the heat out of this market. It still allows people to invest for their future if they wish, but you don't have these circumstances. And we've even got politicians who on their register own upwards of 15 houses. That just seems absolutely ridiculous in a market like this, where we've got people living on the streets because they can't find homes, and individuals own up to 15. It seems quite strange.
Yeah, and look, you know, it's frustrating when people like you and I have such simple, you know, fixes. I mean, like, if I was in government, I'd say to you, Rob, do you want a job in the advice board? Because it's such simple and logical advice that it might work. I think from a investment standpoint, a lot of the investment stock is held by mums and dads, and they're just trying to create a portfolio of wealth.
I've done it myself, and you probably have as well. I mean, I'm in a position now because I've been able to utilise capital gains on a couple of properties to get me where I am. So I understand the need for it, and it creates housing. However, when it becomes your entire business, it seems that it's out of whack.
Yes, it is. It is. It is out of whack, and you're dumbfounded, aren't you? I mean, there's just really no logical, simple answer to go, we'll try this, try that, but certainly a cap makes sense.
And it wouldn't be that difficult to implement, but from where you sit, and you know the people that are out there doing the investing, they're keen to utilise the position they're in to improve their net wealth. But is it just a simple matter if they can't do it with a fourth or fifth property, they would just naturally go down the path of a share portfolio or something so that there's still active wealth building, but it doesn't have to have this negative impact on the housing market?
Yeah, look, I mean, it is probably a little bit outside of my licence when I'm talking about this sort of stuff, but certainly where the borrowing capacity meets... Sorry, where a person's borrowing capacity is capped out, what we do see post that time to 18 months to sort of 3 or 4 years down the track when we come back and do annual reviews, etc., we do see that there is a portfolio building, particularly outside of property, whether that be in blue chips or resources.
Let's have a year in review. If I was talking to you on January the 1st and asked you, what do you think is going to happen this year? Chris, did it turn out like you thought, or did you have some real gobsmack moments about where the property market and the investment market has gone?
Yeah, look, I think if we were having this conversation, you know, circa 12 months ago, I don't know that I would see rates as high as they are currently. I think I was always going to see value plateau. I didn't think that it was always going to, you know, the bottom was going to fall out, nor did I think that rates would skyrocket to uncontrollable levels. But what has surprised me, and probably my dear moment, you know, was that November rate rise. And I think that's probably not broken, but it's gone close to problematic nature of people being able to buy property because the borrowing capacity and the property prices just don't match up. And the repayments on a rate, on a loan to buy a property at the moment are problematic on a family budget. So we're seeing a lot of people just told off at the moment, which isn't ideal either if you're trying to sell.
I thought most people that I socialise with were also gobsmacked with the November one, and it seemed to be driven by one of two things, an agenda by a group of people that need the support of more interest rates, or a complete disconnect with the board, the bank board, and the reality of the world. Because to me it seems really dumb. The people who are getting hurt most are the people who can't afford it. The ones that are causing the rise in inflation are retirees, if you like, that have now got more money because interest rates have gone up, so they're rushing around spending it, putting inflation up, and now they've put more pressure on one and more spending power to the other, and that can only increase inflation. It looked really, really dumb. Was that the way you viewed it amongst your peers?
Look, I'll say this: I don't disagree with anything you said there, as much as I can say, but I certainly don't disagree with you.
Yeah, it just seemed very, very odd. But it also, talk about another one in February or March, I can't see why it would be needed. But on the ground, is the effect of the interest rate rise, is it doing anything like what it's expected to do?
Oh, it is amongst families. Families are pulling right back. You know, and Christmas is very different this year, and holidays are state holidays, not, you know, Gold Coast Perth, etc., overseas, you know, nobody's really looking at that. And instead of playing, you know, three or four sports throughout the year in one summer season or winter season, it's, you know, now pick one. Very different to retirees who are getting excellent returns on their cash, who have little, if any, debt, who are able to, you know, very much live off their investment.
Now, tell us about your own business. You run a business called Foster Ramsey Finance. You're the principal broker. So for your business model, how's this year's outcomes affected what you're doing? Has it been a positive, or has it made life a bit tougher for you?
No, I think, you know, we've still been able to maintain growth. I think that's probably the main thing in small businesses. As long as you're able to grow and to continue to trade through the tough times, and you've got, you know, we're very lucky. I've got an awesome team around me that works very well on things, and we certainly have been able to hold our market position, which has been really reassuring. Our customers and our customer services, customer service offered to people in terms of going to their bank and asking for a better rate, seems to be working well. So I think, you know, in small business, it's about just working out how you navigate through the tougher times being at the moment, and minimise things that perhaps don't make sense. So, you know, discretionary spending in business, which can mean a million different things depending on the industry, but really spending where it matters and really looking after and servicing the customers that support you so well. So I think that's been our key to success this year.
Yeah, it's a good point. I was going to ask you about that. We have an accountant firm that comes in regularly and talks to us, and we talk a lot about how the government change to policy changes the messaging to the customers. Have you, across the year, as a team, developed a new strategy about how you advise your clients on what they're doing around their borrowing?
Yeah, we have. And a lot of the concern has come from what rates are currently doing. And it's been a matter of trying to educate is probably the best word I can use there. I know it means a lot of different things, but what I'm trying to say is that, you know, the price of money now is likely to be the price of money for the next 12 months. I doubt that it will go back to where it was. So in terms of, you know, Mr. Customer, your family budget, I would recommend that when you're doing the numbers to make sure that, you know, this amount of money will cost you this amount per month, then it makes sense to be able to run that sort of figure across the next 12 months, because I don't see it spiking up nor down. So I think that's probably taken a lot of the heat out of most of the conversations that we're having, because that seems to be the pain point. If I borrow this money, how much is it going to cost me? And then outside of that, I think it's probably just property selection and location selection is next, you know, helping people understand the old rules of property.
I've had a bit of experience in the banking world, and there was a time where you'd be advising customers of the clever use of credit cards in your family budget and managing your home loan. You could save yourself quite a lot of money, but of course there is the risk of it becoming a bit of a trap as well, particularly at this time of year when you're wanting to provide a really good Christmas for your family. Have you noticed a change in the use of and the way you advise your clients around credit cards?
Yes, we have, and our particular business doesn't really talk through the credit card sweeping technique much anymore. We tend to suggest that, you know, any savings used go more into the offset account, and the offset account operates as the old credit card would. So that becomes your day-to-day account. It has a Visa debit or MasterCard debit attached to it, so you can still tap and go. It's just the difference being your money rather than you know, a credit card. Therefore, it's harder for it to become out of control. Secondly, though, I would say that, you know, we do see a small number of customers who still use the credit card sweeping, and those customers can control it well because they have not only have the resources to back it up in terms of large, very large, very, very large offset balances to be able to meet that credit card limit several times over. So if it did come out of control, it would remain under control. But yeah, I think that particularly at this time of year, it's very tempting and very easy to get stuck into the credit card. Worry about it later, which just becomes a problem in January, February, March.
Yeah, it really is has been quite serious in the past, and I would have thought in this day and age even more so. But all in all, people are still trying to get into homes for the first time. The methods of parents helping, are there ways that you advise around that? Because some of them can get quite messy. Have you come up with a strategy that if parents are willing to put their hand up, the best way for them to help without putting either party at risk?
Yeah. So our position on that is every case is different, and we would suggest that, we as brokers would meet with the family in whole and guarantors separately and the applicant separately, probably up to twice. So, you know, what's that, 5 or 6 meetings just to discuss the intricacies of lending responsibility around family guarantees and what can go wrong. I mean, there are a million reasons why you do it, and you know, a million and one why you wouldn't. So it just needs to fit with the circumstance for that particular purchaser and their family. And you know, we have some strategies which we discuss in detail as to if things go sideways, how to address that, and for the applicant, the person taking the loan, how they can minimise the amount of time that parents are co-securing that family guarantee or that property, that purchase, with their child or sibling.
Yeah, it's excellent advice, because we're always trying to look for an angle to make it a little bit easier, because we're not getting much help from other places. But let's hope some new strategies from government, both state and federal, next year might look at this very, very serious problem. And I know organisations like yours are always willing to help with advice and strategy, and it's much appreciated. Chris, we thank you for your time, not just today, this year. I mean, really, really enjoyed our conversations, and I'm sure they're helping the listeners, and it's good to have a chat, and hopefully we'll talk to you more again in 2024.
Likewise, and I'd love that. Thanks so much, Rob.
All the very best. Chris Ross de Ramsey.